Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out until our 29th year of marriage that we were a neurodiverse couple. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who is doing fantastic and thriving. And today I am excited to have Enoch back on the podcast to talk about his other word pictures. And if you have not heard his first episode, I will put that in the show notes so that you can listen to that one. You don't have to listen to that one first, but there's so much information and helpful insights that Enoch offers that I hope you'll listen to both. So Enoch, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk to you again. Can you share a little bit about kind of what brought you to the point that we're doing this podcast, kind of an intro?
Sure. I was married for 21 years, and my divorce finalized less than a month ago, actually. We did not know that we were neurodiverse for at least 16 years, after which point there was ADD was part of my partner's diagnosis. And then about 3 years after that, I began to suspect that another form of neurodiversity might be at play. So we went through different counseling, including counseling with a neurodiverse informed counselor, but it didn't work out. And so we ended up having to divorce after a couple of different counselors. Yeah. So I've been on a journey of healing. A lot of it has come through being part of neurotypical support groups, particularly starting with the ones that you hosted, Mona. So thank you for being a part of that healing journey for me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And it's so wonderful that we're able to have these conversations now. And, you know, this is part of your healing journey too, and hopefully will help a lot of other folks too. And so I know one of the things that I hear often from both partners, but we're specifically going to address this for the neurotypical or non-autistic partner, is the frustration about the inability to connect. And I just want to say, for those folks that are listening that are autistic, and I said this on the last episode, here's an opportunity for you to share some of the things that we're going to be talking about with your partner to see if these are things that they're feeling or experiencing. And it also gives you an opportunity to talk to better, hopefully, understand each other and accept that you have differences and see if there's opportunities for healing, for repair, if there's been, you know, a lot of conflict, and an opportunity to see how you can grow together if you continue in your relationship. So let's talk a little bit about the frustration that you have felt and you've heard from others they have felt in their neurodiverse relationships.
Thank you, Mona. I just want to preface our discussion by saying that these models that I've come up with are intended to help describe the frustration that an NT partner may feel when they're not able to connect with their neurodiverse partner in ways that are meaningful and significant to the NT. So they may help probe the scope of our injuries, our experienced deprivations, and the depth of our pain. And maybe, perhaps, it may give voice to a part of us that have been silenced and neglected and left to wither away, or at least that feels that way to us. I'd like to propose that relationships are based on expectations, with different types of relationships having differing levels of expectation. So you think about the difference between the relationship you have with a person at the checkout counter at the grocery store and compare it to a person who works in the same building with you at work, or compare it to a neighbor or to a friend or to a lover, and then you compare it to a spouse. The deeper the relationship, the more trust there is going to be expected to be built to support that relationship. And for the neurotypical, the NT, the most privileged, the deepest, and the most significant of all relationships is the marriage relationship. So this relationship is marked by the highest level of trust that is expected of it. For a neurotypical, the intimacy is the outcome of the trust that has been built over time when the neurotypical shares vulnerably, and five key things take place. And these five things take place at a deeper, more frequent level in the marriage type relationship than any of the other categories or types of relationships that I described earlier. So the five things are, first, their partner acknowledges the treasures that have been shared with them. And the treasures could either be a pain and a need, or hope and a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Then the partner anticipates what their neurotypical partner enjoys or needs in real time and works to accommodate those needs and life. So anticipates is number two, and accommodates is number three. And they regularly demonstrate appreciation for the neurotypical partner and then communicates that to the neurotypical partner that they are adored by their partner. So I call these the five A's of attunement that lead to intimacy: acknowledging, anticipating, accommodating, appreciating, and adoring.
Can I just stop there for a second so that folks can kind of take that in? Because I think the five A's are wonderful. And I think that I'm always saying, you know, there are different ways in which we appreciate our partners depending on our brain type, you know, our neurology, our trauma. And so acknowledging treasures might look very different for each partner. And we can talk about that as we move forward. And anticipating needs is one area where I hear from a lot of the non-autistic neurotypical partners that they feel that there isn't necessarily that connection. And I just want listeners to think about why that may not exist in your relationship. And part of it may be that you haven't talked about it. You know, you haven't communicated that to your partner. And it also may be that because you have such different needs, one or both of you may not fully appreciate the other's needs and may judge or even get angry that your partner has those needs. So I think these are great. And I know we'll probably talk about them throughout. So thank you for sharing those.
Yeah. So when those five A's of attunement are not present with regularity, a neurotypical may find it difficult to feel a sense of intimacy and emotional connection. This is most acute in their marriage relationship, which is the highest, the deepest type of relationship, the most privileged for a neurotypical. So why is it that the neurotypical feels that their neurodiverse partners are not able to meet their relational needs? And by relational needs, I'm going to hone in on verbal and emotional reciprocity to begin with. And I'd like to explore this from two different angles. From the neurotypical's perspective, sometimes it can seem that either A, the neurodiverse partner has difficulty perceiving our needs, and particularly our emotional needs, and B, sometimes it can seem that they may have difficulty prioritizing our needs. And I've come up with two word pictures which illustrate how this may feel to an NT.
Okay.
So the first one, I call it color versus monochrome worlds. So let's say that our neurotypical world is a world of color. Our NT world of positive emotions is akin to the colors of the rainbow with an infinite number of hues, shades, and intensities. And it is these different colors that provide beauty, complexity, and nuance in various degrees of strength for each of those feelings all at the same time. We neurotypicals intuitively and instinctively talk about our feelings, and we display them via nonverbal means, and we derive pleasure in sharing them with others. Indeed, the exchange of these feelings in real time, both verbally and nonverbally, are some of the basic building blocks that an NT requires for intimacy and joy. When we can share our feelings and they are received and reflected back and amplified by another individual in real time. So as NTs, our need for emotional connection revolve around our significant other being attuned to our feelings. Our partners are going to be at a very severe disadvantage, relational disadvantage, if they have a hard time perceiving our reality, the complexities and nuances and the varying intensities of our feelings in the first place. So I would propose that some neurodiverse people, partners, have a difficult time seeing or perceiving that emotional color and nuance. It can feel to an NT that their partner is somewhat colorblind if we equate the ability to see with the ability to perceive and react appropriately to emotions in real time. Perhaps our partners are figuratively only able to see in monochrome, like experiencing life through a black and white television. It's been said that 70% or more of communication is nonverbal. If it is via nonverbal communication, what is being communicated is an emotional state. So if our ND partner has difficulty perceiving these nonverbals, the tone, our cadence, the inflection of our voice, subtle facial movements or altered features, the direction of our gaze, the posture of our body and our extremities, extra moisture in our eyes, or the increased speed of our breathing, it might be akin to a person who is colorblind and can't see the specific colors of our emotions.
Mm.
So we in NTs exist in our color world and desperately want to share it with our most significant other, but then find that our neurodiverse partners can't access the richness and complexities of our feelings in the present. Imagine trying to describe the experience we have when watching a golden sunset at the beach with the pink and purple clouds behind us and the brown hillsides in the distance with green trees and blossoming flowers in the foreground. How do you describe that to someone who is colorblind or can only see in grayscale? Can they get the wonder and the sheer joy and pleasure that we derive from this scene if they can only perceive in black and white and grayscale? And if they cannot see our emotional needs, how are they going to meet them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, Enoch, I love, again, your word pictures are so descriptive and I know are going to help a lot of folks. And I'm going to look at this through the autistic partner's lens for just a moment. And what I want to put out to the listeners is, here's an opportunity for the autistic partners to describe their world and their reality with their partners, because I know for a lot of autistic partners that I have met or autistic individuals that I have met, many are dealing with alexithymia. And so if you're not familiar with alexithymia, that is where you have challenges understanding your own emotions and feelings and therefore have challenges understanding others. But through the help of a therapist or a coach who understands neurodiverse relationships, I think there are opportunities to bridge this divide, but it's never going to be exactly what the neurotypical or non-autistic partner has dreamt of. It will look different. And I also think as I, again, learn more about the autistic people in my life and that I meet, many autistic people talk about how they feel so overwhelmed when they are in different environments or they're watching their partners become emotional. And that overwhelmed feeling leads to sensory overload, which can lead to a shutdown or a meltdown. So I'm just trying in this conversation, and you know, Enoch and I talked about this when we were preparing, to kind of highlight why there can be so many challenges when the neurotypical partner is looking for that emotional connection and their autistic or neurodivergent partner is literally overwhelmed by all the sensory things that they're experiencing. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on what I just shared, Enoch.
Yeah, I think that will lead us to the second picture, this why is there the overwhelm? But I do want to circle back a little bit to how the NT responds to this. Because it's easy for a neurotypical to imagine that their partner is just willfully disregarding them, that the neurodiverse partner just doesn't care or is intentionally withholding something, but I don't think it necessarily needs to be purposeful. I think it could just be a difficulty in the partner recognizing and perceiving those needs in the first place.
Sure.
And I'd like to take this color monochrome metaphor a little further, because it can sometimes seem too neurotypical that the ND partner perceives things in such as our feelings in all or nothing terms, black and white. It's a high contrast environment, and it may be difficult for their partner to deal with the in-between, the shades of gray. So some neurodiverse partners are more apt to see and interpret only basic emotions such as angry, sad, happy, and excited. And if they perceive that, it's 100% so. So all angry or all sad or all mad, and not much in between. No changes in volume, let alone different shades or gradations of feelings, or some of the more nuanced or complex emotions such as remorse or sympathetic anguish. You know, I'd refer to Gottman's feeling wheels a greater panoply of different kinds of more complex emotions. But this really affects the level of connection when the neurotypical experiences these different shades, these different volumes, this different strengths of feelings, and they get interpreted, or they feel like their partner only sees 100 or nothing, all or nothing, and not nothing in between. And whenever there is like mixed feelings, a situation that is full of nuance for a neurotypical, they can feel overlooked. They can feel missed. Things with a binary solution, black or white, are much easier to determine and process, but this can lead to misinterpretation and misunderstanding by the neurodiverse person. They may attribute a stronger feeling to our state than what we actually feel, or they may have difficulty understanding that we have multiple feelings about the same topic portions. So there is a perception part of the color and monochrome model that also adds to the level of disconnect between the neurodiverse and the neurotypical partner.
Yeah.
But there's another side to this metaphor, and that is the fluency aspect. And by fluency, I mean the ability to communicate back and forth about one's feelings and respond to another's feelings in real time. And you alluded to this in when you mentioned alexithymia, because what is intuitive and trivial for neurotypicals to do, which is to perceive verbal and nonverbal signals, may require an enormous amount of cognitive processing in the neurodiverse person's mind to capture and communicate verbally. They may arrive at their feelings through cognitive processing, logical reasoning, cause and effect. And it requires a lot of mental processing for the ND partner to examine what they feel. And it is more like what they think than what they feel. And that may explain why they can communicate feelings more easily through the written medium, when you're not sitting in front of them for real-time reciprocity. NDs may be able to go through their logical analysis and arrive at a description when they have ample time to process it in their mind. But some neurodiverse people have a hard time putting their current emotional state, their feelings, into words. And so that's what you were talking about in alexithymia.
Yeah. And you know, this is so important, I think, for couples to understand, because, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, I can't even tell you hundreds of cards that my ex gave me. I saved them all because they were, every single one of them was absolutely beautiful. He couldn't find the words to tell me what he might be feeling or thinking in the moment, but when we would have a conflict or an argument, or it was a special event, he literally bought me the best cards that I've ever seen. I mean, I think, you know, there aren't many card stores around anymore, but in the olden days, you know, there was Hallmark and American Greetings and whatever. And he probably spent, you know, hours looking for the right card. And he also was a songwriter. And so he would write me songs or poems. And he was so prolific. He had written probably hundreds of songs. And the way in which he described his feelings, or he used analogies to describe his emotions towards me, mind-blowing. So I just want to put that out there, because sometimes as the non-autistic partner, we're looking for our partner to give us love or share emotions and feelings in the way we most want to receive it. But is your partner giving it to you in another way? The other thing that I've seen in one of the relationships that I had with an autistic man was acts of service. So he could not put into words what he was feeling towards me or when he was upset. But what he would do is he would make me dinner. He would do kind, nice things for me, you know, make me a drink, whatever. It wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't what I was looking for. But I recognized that that was his attempt to show me one of the five A's, you know, appreciation, and that he adored me or cared for me. So I think that's helpful for folks to think about too.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that you made, that the communication of that attention and that love is done in different dimensions. And yeah. And I think for the neurotypicals, we really, really want and we really value real-time interaction, that reciprocity in the present. And it may be very difficult for some neurodiverse people to operate on the emotional level in the present, and they do much better in an asynchronous environment. And so I found in my relationship that we communicated best through text messaging or emails. And there wasn't an expectation that there was going to be a communication in the spot, in the moment, right now. But that is a significant level of grieving for the neurotypical who does exist in the present and who wants to have a need met in the present and to want to have their current state anticipated and addressed in the present. And I think a significant amount of the hurt and the feelings of neglect come when they are not attended to in real time, that real time reciprocity in the present.
Yeah. And that's why I often say when I do the couple support groups, the first meeting is about grieving, because we all came into our relationships expecting, and I'm putting that in air quotes, certain things based on, you know, our parents, our grandparents, what we saw on TV, movies, whatever. And we do have to grieve for what might never be. And that's on both sides with both partners. So I think this is going to be really helpful for folks to think about and hear. And are you ready to move on to the next word picture?
Well, I do want to, not quite yet, because you just reminded me of a movie that I think really illustrates the disconnect and the friction and the challenges when we have one party that can operate in one dimension and another party that is not able to. And the movie I'm referring to is Pleasantville from 1998. It featured... It starred Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon, and they were high school kids in the colorful 1990s, and they were transported by a freak of something into the 1950s black and white TV show, something a cross between Leave It to Beaver and... there's another one where we
Father have, Knows Best.
Father yeah, knows Father's best, Knows Best. Yeah. Where everything is predictable. Everything is sugar coated. Everything happens in the right way. And it really illustrates a challenge between a party who really values the sameness and predictability, and another party who finds life in growth, in change, and it's I think the movie wasn't intended necessarily as a metaphor between the struggles between a neurodiverse and a neurotypical relationship, but I think when you view that movie from the lens of the disconnect in emotional fluency between a neurotypical and a neurodiverse person, I think a lot of things start to make sense, or it's a really good parable of that. And the more you watch the movie, the more you see that there can be some insights to why a person who wants things to be predictable and the same finds comfort in that might miss a connecting experience with somebody who sees in the dimensions of color that really aren't accessible or are threatening to the person who lives in a Mayville world of black and white and predictability.
Okay. I'll have to watch that movie again. I watched it when it came out a long time ago, so I'll watch it. Awesome. So let's move on to the next word picture that you want to talk about.
Okay. So the first thought was that there might be a difficulty in perceiving the neurotypical's needs, emotional needs. The second word picture tries to tease out the idea that maybe it's not, maybe there, what's going on is a difficulty in prioritizing the neurotypical's needs by the neurodiverse. And so to understand why a neurodiverse person might have difficulty prioritizing our needs, I'd like to use the analogy of a computer's central processing unit, the CPU. Mm-hmm. Early computers had a CPU that could handle one instruction at a time. In computer speak, this is known as being able to handle a single-threaded operation. Those CPUs could only process one operation at a time, and those operations could only happen in sequence, one after the other. Later computers had more complicated or complex CPUs that could handle multiple operations at the same time in parallel. These became known as multi-threaded capable CPUs. Some people might even call them multiprocessor CPUs. These could handle multiple or separate operations and calculations at the same time. And the fancy name for these processors that can handle multiple operations in parallel is hyper-threaded. And each operation could be completely different and unrelated to the other threads that were being handled. So mm-hmm. I believe that many neurodiverse brains have a certain type of executive functioning difficulties that make those brains operate in a more single-threaded way, so that the neurodiverse can only focus on one main idea or one operation at a time. In contrast, I would model the neurotypical brain as hyper-threading capable, and thus are able to multi-process all the time, able to maintain multiple thoughts, multiple sensory inputs and perspectives in consciousness, their short-term memory, all at the same time. This is what allows an NT to have a more advanced theory of mind. That ability to hold one's own thoughts and feelings are distinct and different from another person's thoughts and feelings sitting across the table. And those, that NT hyper-threading brain can hold these two different realities at the same time and not lose track of oneself nor the other's perspective. And more importantly, can jump between one perspective and back and forth instantly. This is how we can have a conversation with ourselves in our own minds while we are also having a conversation with someone else. I'm speaking from an NT point of view. We mm-hmm. can examine how we feel about what someone is saying and start to think about what we want to say build onto what they are saying or rebut what they are saying, but we can hold that thought within us and not lose track of that, what the other person is saying, while also observing their nonverbal cues that are being expressed constantly. It's an instinctive and reflexive and so ingrained into who we are that it takes us no effort at all. And this is at the core of our neurotypical experience of empathy, the real-time reciprocity of the full range of emotional expression of ourselves and of the partner or the person that we're interacting with. So the neurodiverse brain, on the other hand, might be modeled as a single-threaded processor that can only operate on a single problem at a time. It can't multi-process and work on multiple things at the time. So like holding one's own reality and considering someone else's reality, which might be completely different from the first person's, without losing track of the first one. They may have difficulty listening to words and reading facial expressions at the same time, noticing tones and inflections in the voice while also trying to make sense of the words and adding nuance to the meaning of the words based on a deluge of nonverbal signals that are out there. The focus of that single processor may be on the specific words being spoken to the exclusion of everything else. Some may be so constrained that they can't think of their own thoughts while listening to someone else speak. So they may tend to process externally as they speak and as they hear the words coming out of their own mouth.
Yeah. Can we stop there for a second, Enoch? Because yeah. This is so powerful. And the descriptor, I think, is going to be the word picture and descriptions you're using are going to be so helpful to a lot of folks out there. And I repeatedly saw this in my marriage, my ex-husband, especially when I would get emotional and try to get him to participate in an emotional conversation. He literally would take the words and mouth them to himself. He'd move his mouth. And it would drive me bonkers. And I know I've said this before on the podcast because I didn't understand. I think, and I've heard this from other autistic folks who do this, that he was trying to almost memorize what I was saying so that he could process it. And neither one of us realized that this was going on. And for those of us that are not autistic, when we do get emotional, I do think it's very, very difficult for our partners to hear anything we say. I think that's for most people. And so I think it's really important for couples as they see themselves or their partner getting emotional to pause, to take time out so that there could be an opportunity for your partner to process what you want them to process. Because when our nervous system gets dysregulated and there's too much emotion, too much sensory overload, I don't even know that our partners can process the one thing we're trying to get across. And so it's just a thought for folks to consider and to have a discussion about, you know, what do you need when you're emotionally dysregulated or your nervous system is dysregulated or you're no longer hearing your partner who's trying to explain with tears and emotion how they feel. Because that just, I can tell you, Enoch, that my ex and I had 2, 3, 4 hour roundabout arguments, conversations, conflict that never amounted to anything but Mona crying, 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 Mona screaming, 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 and my ex just shutting down. Mm. And yeah, and so I say that with the most grace for him and even for myself, because I didn't know. And for those that are listening, please, please, please talk about this, figure out what you both need so that you can process these important things that you want each other to understand. So I just wanted to take a pause and share that.
Yeah. So let's dive into what the implications of this single versus multiple processing CPU has. First of all, I would proposed that single-threaded processors have difficulty shifting focus from one operation to the other, and that it's very energy consuming to reorient that processor to switch from one problem to the next. And I would also say that I believe that neurodiverse people may be more susceptible to sensory inputs, and that every sensory input that they perceive, they need to process in the moment just to understand what to do with that sensory input. And that becomes even more energy intensive if you're in a conversation or if you're trying to relate in real time with somebody, and you're also, your processor is trying to deal with all these sensory inputs.
Right.
And the voice of the person you're talking to is one input, but there's also something your eye sees in the corner, some movement or some light over here or some sound in the background. All these inputs are coming in and overwhelming that processor. And so when that processor gets overwhelmed, the frustration level rises. In an NT brain, I would argue that the NT brain not only is able to multiprocess and carry concurrent trains of thoughts or concurrent processing at the same time, there is also what in technology speak and computer speak, I'm a director of technology, so I've got access to these technical terms. But that I would say that the neurotypical brain has something called a hypervisor. And a hypervisor is kind of like a conductor of an orchestra. And it plays the role of an executive functioning manager, which directs attention and keeps multiple parallel processes humming along without getting confused. And it's able to place each thread in context and deprecate the importance of non-essential inputs while highlighting for attention those particular inputs, such as the nonverbal inputs in nonverbal communication, that are providing context for the bigger story. So an ND brain, which is single-threaded, must deal with each input sequentially and quickly becomes overwhelmed by too many inputs or gets lost jumping from one input to the next and forgetting any context, since there is no hypervisor to put things all together within short-term memory. But because of this, the barrage of stimulus, and with each stimulus worthy of equal weight and importance, the ND brain has difficulty focusing attention and priority on someone else's reality. Their own reality is bombarding them with too many inputs to process, and they reach their cognitive processing limit, and then the CPU can shut down.
Yeah, this is so important. And again, this word picture analogy is going to be so valuable. And I always recommend to couples that if you want to have a good conversation that is hopefully healthy and respectful, do it at a time when you're both, you have the bandwidth to do it. So Mona would bombard her ex-husband with information the second he walked through the door. Don't do that. You know, it was overwhelming. You know, one of the places where we had a lot of good conversations was when we were in the car and he would always drive. So, and if I kept it to one topic, that would be helpful, but it was hard for me to keep it to one topic. But I think that it's important for neurodiverse couples to talk about whether or not, or ask whether or not it's a good time to share or talk or process before they go into sharing information, because it's not respectful. And again, I wish I had known that in my marriage. I did do this in future relationships. But when we don't do that and we don't respect each other's bandwidth and processing speed, because many people who are neurodivergent have sensory processing differences. So we process information differently. We process the sensory issues around us differently. And we may get to overload very, very quickly, like you said. So just some thoughts for couples to think about. Again, if you need a third party to help with this, there are folks that are available, and you can check out my website where I list the couples, therapists, and coaches who have expertise in neurodiverse relationships and have been on the podcast. So anything else about the CPUs before we go on to the last word picture?
Yeah, a couple more things. I think the helpful part of this word picture is that it helps the neurotypical reinterpret the lack or what's missing in that connection. And it's not that the neurodiverse partner doesn't care. It's that their cognitive-based brain of their ND partner may just be overwhelmed. And so it takes imagination and anticipation to come up with an engaging question for a partner and an ability to project into the partner's world to fathom what might be important to them to spark that question. And that's the basis for initiating a conversation. So if our partners, our ND partners, have just a single-threaded processor, they may not be able to cope with the myriad of perspectives and sensory inputs that an NT brain can do reflexively. So it could be a processing capacity issue that limits the prioritization of focus in the ND brain that causes an ND person to appear disengaged, aloof, or impassive to the NT. But if we view our partner's lack of engagement or lack of initiation or lack of follow-through through the lens of lacking the capacity to do so because of the processor preoccupation with single processes, it shifts the reason for the deprivation we experience from a feeling of willful neglect towards an executive functioning impairment. Now, it doesn't address the deprivation we may feel, but it may take some of the edge off of our animus towards our seemingly indifferent partner. Now, if I may, I'd like to extend this word picture a little further and fill out another aspect of what the implications of this are. And I would argue, or I would propose, that one of the functions available to a multiprocessor capable brain is automatic keeping track of time. Mm-hmm. This happens automatically without any conscious effort, since one of the processing threads can be doing this in the time in the background. And I would propose that one of those processes for a neurotypical brain is an automatically timestamping of everything that we do, our memories, the words that we speak. They're automatically timestamped. And as they are encoded in our memory, part of that encoding includes the time aspect. So I believe that neurotypical people and neurodiverse people may travel through time in very different manners. I would posit that some neurodiverse people may have what appears to be a slower clock speed than an NT, and that their horizon for the time that they can see and perceive may be limited to the present and just the few minutes behind the present. The neurotypical person might be able to project into the future, which helps with planning and anticipation of options in the future. And they can remember back into the past and have a sense of how long in the past something took place. In effect, for a neurotypical, memories are timestamped at the point of memory creation so that the NT can intuitively sense how far back in time a memory was in reference to the present. It helps one keep pace in a conversation and place conversations into the context of what was just said versus what was just said 5 minutes ago, or 10 minutes ago, or 30 minutes ago, or an hour ago. And of course, yesterday, and last week, and last month. For a neurodiverse individual, memories are not encoded with a timestamp, so all memories are in the present when the memory is recalled. So when a neurodiverse person remembers something we said 15 years ago, they think that is in effect in the current time. They may create a rule based on that memory of 15 years ago, such as, oh, despite spouse likes to have their birthday celebrated and is disappointed if it was not celebrated. And what they remember is this rule. So when the spouse's birthday comes around, the rule gets triggered and the ND partner goes into crisis mode thinking, oh, they better not fail to properly celebrate the spouse's birthday or else the spouse is going to be really disappointed and they will have failed. Fast forward to the present and the spouse's birthday comes by and the ND partner, for whatever reason, does not recognize nor celebrate the spouse's birthday, but then feels guilt and shame over not having done so. They then project onto their NT spouse the sense of blame, thinking that the NT spouse is going to be incredibly disappointed in the ND spouse for not celebrating the NT spouse's birthday appropriately, and that the ND partner is a failure. In reality, the NT spouse might be a little perturbed that their birthday was not celebrated by the family, but it's not such a big deal because the NT spouse has learned to be self-proactive and finds friends to celebrate them with them and doesn't rely on that from the ND spouse. But the ND partner has no clue about this because their experience of reality is the present. And in the present, the calendar says the NT spouse's birthday, and that triggers a rule recollection. Ah, the spouse will be hugely disappointed if their birthday is not celebrated. So the ND partner, feeling ashamed at failing again, goes into defensive mode, which sometimes appears offensive to the NT, and implies that the NT spouse is going to be blaming them for failing yet again. So the fact that this rule about birthdays was based on a conversation 15 years ago and expressed the NT spouse's feeling at that specific point in time a long time ago and may not be as significant or even on the radar of the NT spouse in the present doesn't matter because the ND partner has made their assumptions. So for an NT spouse with time-stamped memories, the older the memory is of an emotional event, the more natural decay is automatically applied to the importance of that experience in relation to the present time. So this time blindness may also affect the level of depth that a current conversation can have. If the time blindness is severe and the ND partner can only remember the last 5 minutes of the conversation or perhaps 15 minutes, then it makes having a deeper conversation that spirals based on what was said before difficult. It also means that context is often lost in a conversation, and the ND spouse may remember snippets of a conversation, and probably more accurately, they remember the sense of feeling that they derive from a snippet of a conversation, particularly a negative one, but not the specific words that were said in the context of a larger conversation. Their bubble of reality may be a smaller bubble extending maybe 5 minutes into the past, whereas an NT's bubble of reality, where they remember thoughts, feelings, and specific words in a conversation, may be much longer, an hour, a day, or a week. This could lead to two separate realities for the NT and the ND partner. In a sense, both realities are true for each individual, but because the time horizon is different, and the specific item remembered is different. In one case, it is a feeling, and in the other case, it may be specific words in the context of a longer stream of dialogue. The potential for friction, reality clashes, and the feelings of both parties of being unheard or misunderstood are astronomical, if not inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one concept that you mentioned, time blindness, is something that folks can do a little research on, and theory of mind. Both of those are concepts that I've talked about on the podcast before, but would be helpful for both partners to explore and to talk about. And I also recommend to folks that you get a digital download deck of the Neurodiverse Love Conversation cards. It's 52 questions that I wish my ex-husband and I had asked each other. And then I recently released the Neurodiverse Love Conversation Card Workbook, which I added another 52 questions. So there's 104 questions in that. And you can write down your responses. And I think that would have been so helpful in my marriage because if something changed, if we had different opinions regarding something or we wanted to readdress something, it's written down there for both of us. I always used to say to my ex-husband, I wish I could have recorded our conversation because I know that this is what we talked about. And he's like, I have no memory of that or whatever. Now I understand it, but it was so frustrating, I think, for both of us. So I would highly recommend to folks that haven't gotten a copy or the digital download of the Neurodiverse Love Conversations to get those or the workbook, and then to add other questions that you each have that you want answers to that aren't included in the deck or the workbook. So if you don't mind, can we wrap up this one so we can move on to the last one?
Yep. I think I'm done with that one.
Okay, fantastic. I think it's going to be really, really helpful. So let's go on to the last one, which you call the funny car. So share a little bit about that, and then we will wrap up.
Sure. This one I came across based on a conversation we had in one of the neurotypical support groups, where one of the people was saying, you know, I feel like I just went and bought a new car, and when I brought the car home, I can't use it anymore. I can't take it out of the garage. It's kind of stuck. And the neighbors come over and they love the car, and the mechanic checks out the car and the mechanic says the car is fine, but I can just never get the car out of the garage. The car doesn't want to run, and they get really frustrated. And so I kind of built this next word picture based on that premise. And that premise is that when we neurotypicals get married, it's kind of like akin to buying a new car, and you have these hopes and dreams for what you can do with this new car. And you come home and you want to take the car out for a spin. You want to go on adventures together. But over time, we get frustrated that what we thought we signed up for is not able to happen. And so so what I would propose is that what happens when we got married is we got married to a specific kind of car. And that car is was not known to us as a particular type. But if you remember back in the maybe 60s, they had the idea of drag racing, and they had these cars called funny cars. It's a special kind of drag racing vehicle. And when we say drag racing, that kind of race happens on a quarter mile track. It's a straightaway track. And these are very, very high powered, high performance vehicles. But they are designed for one thing and one thing only. And that is to accelerate super fast and faster than anybody else and beat the other car in a quarter mile drag race. Now, most people only see funny cars at a drag race. You don't see them out and about town because they can't negotiate corners very well and they can't drive much farther than a quarter mile. They're coasting the rest of the way. And instead of relying on traditional brakes, they use parachutes to help slow them down because their engines are more powerful than their braking capacity. So the other thing about funny cars is they have fiberglass shells that are bolted on top that make them look like a different kinds of vehicles. And these shells are kind of like masks that can be interchanged, and you can change out the shell and have one kind of funny car look or another funny kind of funny car look, but the shell is only for appearances and really not part of the distinctive performance of the car. So perhaps the high performance drag racing funny car was admired and purchased at a drag racing track. And perhaps it was the star of the show and everybody at the track was in awe of its capabilities. It could turn heads and beat competitors on the quarter mile straightaway. And that fiberglass body, it looks so cool and so stylish. Everyone, family, friends, coworkers, marveled at what a great car it was and that it demonstrated its skill so well on the quarter mile track. But after purchasing the funny car, the new owner decides to bring it home, and for the first time, the funny car is in a different venue. It's completely new to the car, which had only known the garage next to the racing track. The funny car is now being asked to do some things it had never done before, to drive around through a town, navigate intersections, turn corners, maneuver around other cars, which are much more nimble, and then braking at a stoplight or a stop sign. How do you brake without the use of parachutes, which are not practical to use outside of a racetrack?
Right.
Pretty soon, the funny car resented being asked to do things it was not designed to do, and it was too overwhelmed by trying to navigate the complexities of driving in a city, with navigation to deal with, traffic patterns to be aware of, proper etiquette of the road. How do you deal with a four-way stop with cars left, right, and in front of you and behind you? Who goes first? Who goes next? If all you have known is to travel in a straight line at a quarter-mile track once the green light is lit, how do you navigate this other new reality? So the owner of this new car is now in a quandary. They have this precious car, but they can't use it for what the car was, for what the owner was hoping to use it for, to get around town, to go visit friends, to take trips, to go on a vacation. The funny car, meanwhile, feels blamed for not being able to do the things that it was not designed to do. It feels unaccepted, and it gets upset that the owner is asking too much of it and is not unwilling to accept the funny car for what it is. The owner, on the other hand, is bewildered because they had no idea that the funny car was not a regular, typical street legal car. Its fiberglass body was so well done, it looked superficially just like a regular Chevrolet Camaro. People at the racetrack, including family, friends, co-workers, they marveled at what a wonderful drag racer this car was, but they never ever needed to take this car out on a trip around town or on a vacation adventure across the country, something only the new owner wanted to do. So the problem then is that the owner did not realize that the car was a funny drag racing car. And funny, I don't mean in a derogatory sense, I mean right. In a descriptive sense of what that is in a drag racer. And that the initial interactions with this high performance car was a special case scenario limited to a drag racing track. The funny car's fiberglass shell had been carefully crafted to mimic a traditional stock car so that the new prospective owner didn't really comprehend the nature of the differences between this kind of car and a regular street legal stock car. The family, friends, and the co-workers also did not realize that their world was limited to the drag racing track, nor did the funny car for that matter. It was only when the new owner who decided to take the funny car out of the microcosm of the racetrack by buying the vehicle through a wedding ceremony and taking the car to a new home away from the racetrack that this came out. So along with a new home came new expectations for what type of relationship the car would have with the owner. Instead of just running quarter mile sprints in a familiar straight line track, there were now expectations for going places and doing things that were completely foreign to the funny car. And the funny car got frustrated at not being able to perform those duties and found it too exhausting and confusing to try to navigate city traffic or even the twists and turns of a country road, and began to shut down. It simply could not keep up with the bewildering demands of its new owner. It wanted the familiarity and safety of that quarter mile straight line drag strip where it knew exactly what to do and what was expected of it, and it could excel at what it was finely tuned to do. And that fiberglass body, it would happily exchange it for another if it needed a different look at another racing venue. It, after all, was a replaceable mask, and it knew how to craft the most amazing shell that would wow and impress the crowds. but don't ask it to turn a corner or weave in between traffic. So from the perspective of the NT, your frustration of being stalled in your dream car lies in your expectation that you could use the dream car to go places. And this is a common and perfectly healthy expectation for near typicals. The dream car is happy that you are in the dream car because they have built-in proximity for the rest of their lives as long as you stay in the car. They have attained their goal of having someone else in the car. But they may have little desire to take the car anywhere since that is not the what cars are for an ND. Once someone else has gotten into the car, that's purpose has been solved. In that sense, the car is more like a mobile home for the ND that at one point had wheels, but now should stay exactly where it is and not go anywhere. The fact that there is someone else in the car has fulfilled the needs for that neurodiverse car. As a neurotypical, however, you have expectations that proximity is not sufficient, but that you want to go places in the car to experience adventures together, to move beyond where you started, to grow, to have companionship through change, to have mutual support through life's challenges. But if the other party is risk and adventure adverse and actually finds those things anxiety producing and terrifying, then you have a severe mismatch in how you are approaching the relationship and what the car is for.
Yeah. And this is, again, a really, really helpful word picture. And I think, again, this is something that I hear repeatedly from both partners. You know, I came into, and it might not be marriage, it might be a long-term relationship. I came into this relationship, and I'm putting in air quotes, expecting these things, and I didn't get them. Or I'm not getting them, or I'll get them and it's not consistent. So I love the analogy of the funny car because it does have tremendous limitations, but you don't know that because of the mask. And a lot of people have shared with me that, you know, now they understand that their autistic or neurodivergent partner was wearing a mask, was using a script in conversation or in the way they dated and the way they pursued them. However, I do know that there are lots of neurodiverse couples out there that are finding ways to understand each other better. Wasn't the case in our marriages, Enoch, but it has been the case in my other relationships, and it has been the case with other couples. And I think what's most important about this analogy for me is understanding not only each other's differences, but each other's strengths and gifts. Because as long as we focus on what each other cannot do in the relationship or will not do in the relationship, we will suffer. I guarantee you. I'd put, you know, money on that bet. And this analogy is going to, again, like the others, hit home for a lot of folks out there who are listening. So we're almost at the end. So I'd like to wrap up. Was there anything else you wanted to say about the funny car?
No, I think that pretty much covers the funny card.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you. First, I want to thank you, Enoch, for putting these concepts down in words. And I know we've talked about this before. I do hope that you put out a book or something that folks can use in the future, because I don't think there's anybody that has done what you have done to create these word pictures. The other thing I'd like you to share is where people can learn more about your website, and if they want to email you, what is the best place for them to do that?
Sure. I do have a web page of on my personal blog, which is ifgodwhy.com, and then /ND for neurodiversity. I didn't initially, when I created that blog, I wasn't having any thought of talking about neurodiversity, but because I already had that website, when I started collecting my resources, it was easy just for me to create a page and put it there. So I think a lot of the resources and the research that I have done that has gone together into putting together these word pictures are the raw material is all there on that webpage, ifgodwhy.com/nd. And I'm thinking of expanding that to another page, which kind of fills out these word pictures and kind of puts it in writing. So if you pay attention to that word, that website over time, I would say maybe in the next couple months, I will be adding some new pages that go into more depth with these word pictures. And hopefully Great. Maybe someday a book.
Yeah, awesome. And then if people want to reach you by email, it's ifgodwhy@gmail.com. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Great. All right. So to wrap up, is there anything else that you want to share with the listeners before we wrap up this podcast episode?
I think I would probably end with the three most critical questions that an NT must wrestle with when they are confronted with this deep sense of frustration and loneliness in their primary relationship. Okay. And the three questions are, first, where on the spectrum, and I use that word spectrum in quotes, does an NT find themselves between being a partner versus being a caregiver in their marriage or primary relationship? Okay. And that is a process that of discovery and of introspection, because for some NT partners, they feel more like a caregiver, and a caregiver is somebody who provides care for another but doesn't expect the other to provide care back in the same way, versus being a partner where there is more of an equal distribution of caregiving or needs being attended to.
Sure.
So that's the first question. The second question is, what are reasonable expectations that the NT may have for the relationship? And reasonable expectations has to take into effect if there are areas of capacity that their partner is unable to perform at the same level as a neurotypical in. Taking into consideration the ability, the capacity to perceive and to react in emotional ways in real time, that reciprocity. So at some level, the neurotypical may feel that they are in a relationship with a person with a relational disability. Mm-hmm. And if that is true, what are reasonable expectations that you can have if there is some sort of relational disability? Just like if you are married to somebody who is a quadriplegic, you have different expectations of what you can do with that person than somebody who has fully functioning legs and arms.
Yeah.
So there needs to be an exploration. What are reasonable expectations if there is indeed some sort of relational disability at play?
Sure.
And then the third question is, are there enough positives to sustain this relationship that's lacking in reciprocity and partnership that you need to feel that type of connection, that type of primary connection with a partner?
Yeah.
And that's really a question that each person can only answer for themselves. It's not going to be a blanket question that applies to everybody, because each individual is so unique and each partner is so unique.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are three good questions to consider. And for those of you that are trying to make a decision about next steps in your relationship and you're going through the discernment process in your own head, I am co-facilitating a monthly support group with Jody Carlton. We meet on the first Wednesday of the month, and we have one group that meets at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and then another group that meets at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We limit the number of people in the group, and it's only $25 to participate. And you can go to Jody Carlton's website and sign up. I will put that in the show notes. But Enoch, thank you so much for sharing these word pictures that I know have been part of your healing journey and are helping others better understand themselves and their partners. And I look forward to continuing to see how your healing journey kind of plays out and what else you do out there in this world of neurodiverse relationships. So thank you.